For centuries, they walked among us, brilliant, strange, and utterly alone. Henry Cavendish, the 18th century scientist who discovered hydrogen and calculated Earth's mass, communicated with his servants only through written notes. When a maid accidentally crossed his path on the stairs, he immediately ordered construction of a second staircase. Neighbors whispered he was a wizard, pointing to the 80-foot pole jutting from his yard. 200 years later, neurologist Oliver Sacks would recognize something else entirely. Cavendish likely had what we now call autism. His extreme single-mindedness, passion for calculation and quantitative exactitude, coupled with a virtual incomprehension of social behaviors, weren't obstacles to his genius. They were inseparable from it. This realization opens a profound question. What if autism isn't a modern epidemic at all, but an ancient part of human diversity we're only now learning to recognize? On the first geek cruise in 2000, I noticed a pattern among programmers heading to Alaska. Larry Wall, creator of Perl, mentioned his autistic daughter. Days later, tech entrepreneur Judy Estrin's brother-in-law said the same. Then, a special education teacher warned, "There is an epidemic of autism in Silicon Valley." Silicon Valley showed disproportionately high demand for autism services. Neurogeneticist Dan Gershwind suggested tech culture created unprecedented social possibilities for people on the spectrum. Engineers marrying engineers, their children inheriting traits from both sides. My article, The Geek Syndrome, explored this assortative mating theory, generating overwhelming response from grateful parents and readers who recognize themselves. Yet, I'd miss the bigger story. Scientists identified over 1,000 candidate genes associated with autism, but promised breakthroughs never materialized. Meanwhile, newly diagnosed adults sharing experiences online revealed that many challenges weren't autism symptoms, but hardships imposed by an unaccommodating society. After 70 years of research, why did we still know so little? 11-year-old Leo Rosa begins each day with a visual schedule featuring icons of his most treasured possession, a green Starbucks straw. His ritual is mesmerizing, tearing the wrapper, nibbling it pliable, then manipulating it into an L shape while twiddling the end. When Shannon couldn't collect enough straws discreetly, she mobilized her online community to form LUST, the League of Unrepentant Straw Thieves. The Rosa family's Santa Cruz Mountains home reflects their adaptation, an open floor plan for pacing and scootering, a backyard trampoline for sensory input. Contrary to myths that autism destroys families, raising Leo has brought the Rosas closer. Shannon initially pursued biomedical interventions, eliminating gluten and consulting Dan doctors, promising to cure Leo's autism. The breaking point came when she realized the doctor would recommend chelation regardless of test results. Instead, they found therapist Fiona, who focused on teaching practical skills rather than extinguishing autistic behaviors. Shannon's perspective shifted. Leo didn't need to be cured. He needed to be understood and supported. In 1930s Vienna, Hans Asperger examined over 200 children displaying social awkwardness, precocious abilities, and fascination with rules. Many had finely chiseled features but wore grave expressions as if prematurely aged by worry. Asperger was impressed by his patients' natural aptitude for science. One chemist spent all his money on experiments that horrified his family. Another stole cyanide from his school's chemistry store. Asperger coined autism and observed it encompassed the highly original genius to the most severe, contact-disturbed, automaton-like, mentally retarded individual. The clinic developed individualized educational approaches, maximizing children's innate gifts without trying to cure autistic traits. These children responded powerfully to logic and pursued learning through passionate interests. The most effective teachers remained calm and objective, becoming somewhat autistic themselves. Meanwhile, in America, Leo Kanner developed a darker understanding. After examining Donald Triplett in 1943, Kanner presented autism as a strictly defined, monolithic condition. By 1948, he blamed parents as cold perfectionists providing mechanicized service. His refrigerator mother theory claimed children sought solitude after being kept neatly in a refrigerator which didn't defrost. Bruno Bettelheim amplified this toxicity, claiming the precipitating factor in infantile autism is the parent's wish that his child did not exist. Bernard Rimland's son Mark screamed for hours and banged his head against walls. Rimland, a naval psychometrician, spent 5 years in medical libraries. His 1964 book, Infantile Autism, proved autism was neurological, not psychological, freeing parents from blame. On November 14, 1965, 35 parents gathered in Teaneck, New Jersey, forming the National Society for Autistic Children. "We should weave a cloth so strong," Rimland told them, "that no one can tear us apart." Lorna Wing revolutionized diagnosis by searching for autistic behaviors among cognitively disabled children rather than starting with Kanner's narrow criteria. She proposed an autism spectrum, recognizing autism as dimensional rather than categorical. Her most radical idea? The spectrum shades imperceptibly into ordinary eccentricity. Following new diagnostic manuals, autism prevalence estimates rose worldwide, not a true epidemic, but a realignment with reality. Wing suggested autism spectrum disorders might affect as many as 1 in 100 children. In May 1989, Temple Grandin, a 44-year-old industrial designer with a PhD, addressed an autism conference. Though unable to speak until age 3, she explained how she understood everything but could not get words out. She described sensory sensitivities as like having a hearing aid stuck on super loud. Oliver Sacks profiled her in his bestseller, An Anthropologist on Mars, presenting her in full humanity, capable of joy, tenderness, and philosophical depth. Jim Sinclair, diagnosed late despite his intelligence, drove 1,200 miles hoping to meet others like himself. With Donna Williams and Kathy Lissner, he launched Autism Network International, the first autistic-run organization. The community created its own terminology, notably neurotypical for non-autistic people. At the 1993 International Autism Conference, Sinclair delivered a movement-defining manifesto. "Don't mourn for us. We are alive, we are real, and we're here waiting for you." In 1996, the first AUTREED gathered nearly 60 participants celebrating autistic culture. Australian student Judy Singer later named this emerging concept neurodiversity. 8 decades after Asperger's work, we know autism isn't a modern aberration, but an ancient part of human diversity. A strange gift from our deep past, passed down through millions of years of evolution. Most cases stem from ancient genes widely distributed in the population. Think of neurodiversity like computer operating systems. Just as different software platforms aren't broken, human brains can operate differently without deficiency. By autistic standards, neurotypical brains are easily distractible, obsessively social, and lack attention to detail. The internet succeeds by being platform agnostic, a model for inclusive society. Practical innovations include sensory-friendly environments, autism-friendly performances, adaptable digital learning, and workplace accommodations like Specialisternes, which employs autistic people in technology roles. Neurodiversity activists demand representation, nothing about us without us. At the Autism Research Institute, Bernie Rimland's desk remains buried under files from parents worldwide. His son Mark, now middle-aged and the mayor of Kensington, has defied early predictions to lead a fulfilling, creative life. Gloria's revelation was learning to work with Mark's strengths rather than fixating on deficits. Once he figured out that he loves art, everything else came along with it. Shortly before his death, Bernie wished to make Mark normal, but he and Gloria had given Mark something better, a community celebrating him exactly as he is. We're finally learning what Asperger knew in 1938. Autistic people have always contributed their unique gifts to humanity's story. The question isn't whether they belong, it's whether we'll make room for them to thrive.